Yeah, I'll let you know.
All right. Should we get started?
Go for it.
All right. So, hey, everybody. I'm Gary Cohen, and I'm happy to be here today. The title of the session is Let's Get Real. And then it's got a really long subtitle, which is just basically we're going to talk about some habits that we have, some even good habits that we have that are maybe getting in the way of us achieving better product outcomes, as weird as that sounds. But just real quickly, a little bit about me. I've been in the software development industry for a long time, have technical background, also product, led engineering and product at different software product companies, currently do coaching and consulting. And I work a lot at the organizational level trying to help people find new ways of working using agile and you know, organizational design and product thinking, things like that. And just me personally, huge sports fan, go Eagles, you know, go Blue, love the Philly Fanatic. He was my hero growing up. And then just kind of weird facts about me. I actually did help develop the NFL scheduling system that they used back in the 1990s, which was an amazing job for me. That's how I knew this country was great, that I actually got paid to do that. And number two, I don't know if you know what ENIAC is, but ENIAC was first ever general purpose computer made up of all these vacuum tubes and things like that in the 1940s at the University of Pennsylvania. I actually got to work on it, but not in the 1940s. Obviously, I wasn't alive. But as a high school summer intern, I actually, part of my responsibility was to polish parts of the pieces of ENIAC. I literally worked on it. But anyway, so that's a little trivia about me. So let's talk about our habits and our best practices, right? And so when we establish best practices, like our agile best practices and our project management best practices and things like that, right? We find a good way of working, and then we start sharing that, and other people find that it's a good way of working, and then it sort of becomes a recipe, right? And if we just follow the recipe, we're going to get to a, you know, to our desired target, our desired outcomes, and everything's really good. And what happens over time is we just kind of blindly follow the recipe, and for a while we get to keep, you know, achieving the outcomes that we want. But the problem is that, you know, after a while, once these things are habit forming, we don't think about
recording
it anymore.
Recording in progress.
Okay. And
elsewhere too.
No, it's okay. So we have these, you know, this recipe. It helps us hit our targets, get our outcomes, until all of a sudden it doesn't, right? And then we're kind of stuck. And we're going to talk today about some things where we've been doing these best practices, following these recipes, and maybe now we're starting to find that it's we're no longer hitting the mark with some of those things. So I don't know how many of you have seen this before, but there's been studies done by several groups, the Standish Group, by Pendo, who does a lot of application statistics and you know, actually sees feature utilization. And these studies have been done over many years, so it isn't just a recent phenomena. But 80% of the features that we put in our software and our products are never or rarely used by our customers, right? That is not a great record. That's not even a great record if you're a baseball batter, right? 20% is not very good. And so even though we have these best practices that we think are helping us deliver great software, right, customers are only using 20% of what we produce, right? So clearly there's some better outcomes we can have, right? And then the other thing that causes us to maybe no longer get the outcomes that we want is that things change, right? And sometimes things change really rapidly. and just an example, right, we have artificial intelligence, and specifically Gen AI, which people are talking about now. And, you know, there's some things that we know that is going to be an impact of AI, right? Certain things we're going to be able to do faster and cheaper, right? And that's a really good thing. But maybe before, our best practices were based on us doing them slower, right? And things being more expensive. So we had to do like more upfront planning or this or that to try and optimize the fact that these other things were slower. So as our capabilities change, right, our practices need to change too. And then there's a lot of uncertainty with Gen AI, like how are people going to use it? You know, like how do we use it in developing software? How will our customers use it, right? Because if our customers are using it to do certain things, then we have to modify our products to meet their needs, right? Because maybe because of AI, some of these things are no longer their needs. So just keep that in mind as, you know, we try and figure out where our habits are maybe not serving us well. So I'm going to start off at the road mapping level, right? So, you know, we're looking at, you know, what, you know, our work. So here's an example of a multi-release roadmap. I just pulled this off of this productboard.com site. What, you know, the actual features that are on here are not important, right? But what we see is, okay, so there are, you know, multiple releases on this plan. So this plan covers, you know, three releases. I'm assuming this is an internal document, not an external roadmap, right? Because we probably don't want to be showing our customers through, you know, out through three releases, but it is an internal plan, right? And so there, you know, on the one hand, this is a perfectly fine multi-release roadmap, but there's definitely some things we want to point out about it. So number one, if we look across, right, the three releases, are we making commitments to build all three of these releases exactly as it's listed here, right? If we are, then first of all, we're not going to be very agile. And number two, we're going like all in on this and, you know, have no ability to react to changes in the marketplace. So that's like one concern here. Actually, one good thing about this is I don't see any timelines on here. So that's positive, right? But we, you know, remember that 80% figure of customers not using features? Well, what's our certainty that our customers will use these features, right? And if we're an average company, then 80% of the features here aren't going to be really used very much. So that's like, why are we focused on delivering all of these things if we know that there's only a 20% chance that they'll actually use them? And then, you know, the way that this is structured with certain features in each release, it doesn't say anything about our certainty as to how long it will take to deliver these features. And now, granted, there's not a time frame on here, but I bet you that people know when release one's supposed to go out. And so there's nothing here that shows any bit of uncertainty, like, hey, you'll definitely get these first four features, but maybe the next three are depending on how things go, right? I mean, there's no sort of uncertainty there. And then you see straight work for three releases, right? There is like no space for saying, you know what, we got some feedback and we want to do a deeper Dropbox integration, you know, that you know, we started in release one. There's no place to do that because otherwise we're pushing other stuff out. So, you know, so that's my concern when we get to multi-release roadmapping. This is actually Roman Pichler's Go roadmap, which, and you know, for those of you who know Roman, he is great. He's like one of the foremost product consultants out there. So there's a lot of stuff I like on here, but I thought it was worthwhile to talk about it too, because I'm still a little concerned that we have a four-quarter roadmap, but realize that leadership often wants to know, hey, kind of what are we going to be doing for the year, right? And which is fine as long as we're revisiting this roadmap every, you know, so often, whether it's every month, whether it's every week, whether it's whatever, hopefully at least once a quarter, you know, but probably more. And Roman will be the first one to, you know, like I saw him say with the, with this thing that, hey, you want to revisit it often. And if you take a look at the, at that third row with the blue kind of oval around it and the target thing there, what I really like about this is that that first bullet point on each of those quarters, those are business outcomes that we want, right? And I think it's really important to, you want to be pretty firm at the business outcome level, what you're trying to achieve. And so that is really good to have out there for the four quarters. And then the bullet point underneath that, where it says like understanding my eating habits, improving my eating habits, that's kind of a functional thematic, you know, a theme that this is how we're going to, these are the problems we're going to solve for the customer. So it's not at a feature level. It's more at a higher level than that. And I really like that. And then if you go down to the bottom row, which is circled in green, these are metrics, right? These are how we're going to know that we're going to be successful. And I like the fact that we determine beforehand what is going to be successful. We're kind of making a decision. We're going to invest in trying to achieve these goals, right? In, you know, the target goals in the third row, and this is how we're going to measure the success. I especially like the first one because it has a specific thing, be in the top 15, right? 6 weeks after launch. I like that. Some of the other ones, like it says what measure we're going to use, and that's important, but it doesn't say what we're hoping to accomplish, right? So that would be my one little thing that I'd like to see on there. But given this, right, and if we revisit it a lot, then we're not tied into specific features. We, you know, there's still a lot of room for discovery and finding out the things that we're uncertain about, right? But we still have a general idea of what direction we're trying to go and what problem we're trying to solve. So, like, much better than the generic multi-release roadmap. And then, you know, a lot of us in the Agile world, we tend to be fond of like now, next, later, right? A little less committal. At least on this one, I've tried to use examples that are pretty high level. They're not down at the user, certainly not the user story level, right? Maybe at the epic level, these are things that we're trying to do. And like, we know that the now we're working on right now. So we're definitely going to do that. The next, right, is okay, once we're done with the now, then we're going to go work on that. And that sounds like pretty, you know, pretty definitive, although it's you know, it's not, although we say next, right? And then later are kind of the thing, based on what we know now, this is what we think we're going to focus on at some, you know, distant point in the future. But I think if we really want to be transparent, we ought to change now, next, later to now, and then probably with a question mark, and then later becomes maybe or never, so that people don't say that's a commitment to go do something, right? So a minor thing, but what I'm trying to push for is the more that we can be transparent, number one, the more that we leave room for learning and dealing with uncertainty and actually being upfront about and recognizing uncertainty, I think the better product outcomes we're going to wind up with. This is at the team level. And again, I just pulled this from productboard.com, but it's got like team one and team two on it. You know, and it's these are the things that the teams are working on. And again, I've done stuff like this, so totally get it. Like there's nothing wrong with it, except for the fact that, like, number one, we're committing these teams out to, you know, several quarters out in the future. Now, if you tell me we revisit this every sprint, right, and potentially change things, then I don't have as much of a problem with it, right, because we're learning new information and we can change things. But as soon as somebody, even if it's internal, as soon as like the CEO or the, you know, the chief revenue officer or somebody, as soon as they see this and take that as a commitment, right, then all of a sudden it's a problem. And I'm going to kind of skip over the fact that, you know, these teams are maybe working on multiple things at the same time. Maybe they should like work on getting that one thing out sooner before, you know, pulling in some of the other stuff, but that's a minor thing. And then the other thing is like, this team is book solid, right? There's no, well, what if we have something we want to refactor in the code, or what if we want to go deeper on something? Maybe we just want a week or two to just be able to, I have this idea and I'd like to go pursue it. And there's nothing on here. And even if we kind of say, oh, you know what, you can go do that, there's something kind of organizationally by not leaving any spaces on here, right? It's kind of saying, even if it's implicit, like, anytime that you're not making progress on this, right, you're not doing your job, right? And that's not what we want, but that's when we book, when we, our roadmaps book the team solid out through whenever, that's some of the message that we're sending. Okay, so let's kind of take a look at this in terms of what makes a better roadmap, right? What are the factors behind it? And so the biggest thing to me is, how often do we revise it? I can take any of those roadmaps that we talked about, and if you tell me that we're going to look at it every week and potentially revise it, and that, you know, that people know that we're going to revise it, so it's not a commitment, then I think that makes for a more powerful roadmap to reflect the uncertainty that there is in product development, right? In creating features and products that our customers will actually use. There's a lot of learning we need to do. And we shouldn't, like, when we put out a solid roadmap and say, this is our plan and this is it, right? We're kind of saying we know exactly what we're doing, and you know, that's not the way to create great products. And that kind of gets to the second point. When there was nothing on any of those roadmaps which kind of represented our uncertainty, you know, the one I liked the best, which was Roman's, you know, roadmap, goal-oriented roadmap, because it was at the goal and the outcome level. And there shouldn't be a lot of uncertainty at the goal and the outcome level, but how we get there, right? And how we solve customers' problems or needs, right, that they're willing to pay us for, and how to do that in a way that's valuable to them and is feasible. That's all, and like how quickly we can do that, that's all uncertainty, and we're not representing that on those roadmaps that we saw. We also talked about how there's no space in there for pivoting, adapting, or stopping. And I think by actually putting that on there, that would send a pretty powerful message to teams. They might be more encouraged to do that. And all of these things were mostly, all of these roadmaps were mostly about one particular solution that, and here are all the steps that we're taking to do that solution. We don't even kind of show, like, hey, there might be multiple ways to do this, right? That's part of the uncertainty. Which features should we do? Which features should we not? Is there a different way to look at this solution? Are we even working on the right problem, right? And so these are things that we don't see on the traditional roadmaps. So I want to talk about this book, Continuous Discovery Habits, by Teresa Torres. Came out in 2021. It's definitely my favorite book of that year. You know, it's amazing, some of the things that she introduces in here. One of the things is we're going to see in a second, is she talks about opportunity solution trees, which allows us to see both the customer problem or opportunity that we're working to solve, along with the business outcome, and then, which is right, the problem space, like what problem are we going to solve? And then, you know, and then we can see alternate solutions for us to address that opportunity. So here's an example of an opportunity solution tree. And so you can see the desired business outcome is up top, and it all starts with that, right? We want something that is viable, right? Meaning that we can make a profit out of it so we can pay our salaries and things like that. We want it to be valuable for the customer, and that's kind of the what pain point are we solving for them? And then we want it to be feasible in the sense that we can build it, and that we can build it in a profitable way. We want it to be usable, right? Which kind of makes it more valuable. And so the idea here is that we figure out a couple of different problems that our potential customers have. We break those opportunities down into kind of smaller, you know, like here's the first step in addressing that opportunity, right? Until we get to, kind of an opportunity that we can really go investigate and then go full bore on. But there we might come up with multiple solutions. And for each solution, right, we want to be very explicit. And this is one of the things I really like about this approach is we're very explicit about these are the things we're uncertain about that are critical assumptions for, like, this has to be true if this is going to not only solve the opportunity, but do so in a way that's viable and feasible and all that stuff. And so we list them out, and the ones that are most critical and the ones that we are least certain about, we want to find the fastest way to test them out, you know, as quickly as possible. Because this way, instead of spending 6 months or 12 months working on a whole series of releases for a solution that's never going to get us the desired outcome, right? We want to get better at finding out quickly, this solution isn't going to get us there. If we can find that out in 2 weeks instead of 6 months, right, then we can move on to the next possible solution, right? And this also makes for a better way to talk about what we're going to be working on next and why that is. So we talked about, you know, critical assumptions and how to quickly validate or invalidate the critical assumptions, especially the ones that we're most uncertain about. And because this keeps the problem and solution spaces right in front of us, and it's a continuous process. Like, it's not just we're going to do the discovery up front and after whatever, a month or 2 months or whatever, we're going to stop doing discovery. We know exactly what we need to do. We're going to spend the next 6 months delivering. No, we're always learning because there's always assumptions to test, and there may be other solutions or other opportunities. If we look back here, right, there are multiple opportunities, multiple solutions that will help us achieve our business objectives. And at any one time, we may learn something that makes, you know, one solution better than the other, or a solution becomes unfeasible, right? And so having that all out in front of us makes for better outcomes. Okay. So we talked about roadmaps. So now we have our roadmap. We've done some initial product discovery, and we're working on product delivery, right? And maybe we have multiple teams working on it. And, some people call that a program. Some people focus in on releases. So let's spend some time talking about how we normally manage our releases and manage our programs and talk about the status. So I'm going to start off with Safe. And Dave, don't hate me here because I'm not ragging on Safe here. I think if Safe is useful for a lot of people, right, and a lot of organizations. So kudos for that, right? I'm just going to be addressing one piece of it that I have a slightly different viewpoint on. And I'm sure that there are places where they're more flexible and they're safe, they're safe implementations, and they can address this. But I know we have, you know, PI planning where we get all the teams together in the release train and coordinate trying to manage dependencies and plan out work for whatever is that next increment, program increment. Usually it's like 8 to 12 weeks or whatever. And so there's nothing wrong. Like, if you're coming from a place where you weren't able to reliably and predictably deliver stuff, then being able to do that, right, is a really good thing. But I think there are some potential issues with it. When we do this, right, there's a couple things. So number one, you know, depending on how long your increment is, right, you're saying we really only need to plan, you know, every 8 to 12 weeks. And I'm sure that nowadays you can release within that, you know, in shorter time frames. But certainly from a planning perspective, you know, that's a long increment for planning. And it may not seem it, like, especially like we used to plan for like 12 months or 18 months or whatever. But like with how quickly things are changing today and how much uncertainty is there, that would be a worry I'd have. Number two, safe is very much about managing dependencies. And, you know, like maybe you're in a place where you don't have as much control over the dependencies. You can't, you know, you can't change the team structures. You can't, you know, reduce the work in progress, you know, to try and eliminate dependencies, right? So we manage them. And that's kind of what we're doing in the PI planning and things like that. That's cool. But I think it's better in the long run if we can focus on eliminating dependencies rather than managing them. And, you know, because dependencies slow us down, right? If we're releasing as a release trainer or whatever, you know, every 8 to 12 weeks, we're only getting what, like 4 to 6 learning, you know, feedback cycles, you know, every year. So that's a little bit worrisome for me. And then, no pun intended here, right? Even though this seems like maybe a safe way to release software because we're all organized together and in a lot of coordination, we're also batching things up potentially. And, you know, like in some ways, we can reduce the risk by releasing continuously and in smaller pieces. And, you know, I know in automated testing, I know like as part of safe and whatever, but like when we're releasing in smaller chunks and having faster feedback loops, that's probably actually the better way to get, especially given the fact that 80% of our features never get used. Like, so to do more learning on the, you know, on that side rather than just being focused on delivery, that helps us out. Then just in general for like program and release management meetings, what are we normally discussing in these meetings, right? And these are generally leadership and either the teams themselves or representatives from the teams, program managers, project managers, whether scrum masters, whatever. And the leaders want to know, how are we doing? Like, are we going to hit our schedule, right? And so we talk about two different things, right? We have the overall status, right, which is red, yellow, green. And if we're being honest, what we usually see is a lot of green and maybe a little yellow and very little red, because what happens when things are red? People start asking us all sorts of questions and like, why are you screwing up? And maybe they don't say it that way, but that's the implication, right? I mean, it's just like when I go to the dentist, right? And you know, just for a regular checkup, and the hygienist is like, so how have your teeth been feeling these last 6 months? My answer is always, they're doing great. There's nothing wrong. There's no need to get the drill out, right? I mean, right? I don't want any more attention on my teeth. You know, like maybe I should, like if I have cavities or whatever, but like I'm not going to offer that information up, right? And it's sort of the same way in these status meetings. Maybe if you have a lot of psychological safety, you'll see a little bit more honesty there. But, and plus we're human, we tend to be very optimistic and, oh, we can get back on track. I'm just going to report it as green, right? That sort of thing. And then the other thing that's a little worrisome is usually we're talking about a single date, right? When we're going to deliver something. And we all know that what we do in developing software and products is really hard. It's complex. right? We don't know the exact day we're going to deliver it. Yet we pretend that we do, right? We put that single date. Oh, well, why do you put a single date? Well, because that's what the executive expects us to, right? To have a single date. And, right, it's just not very transparent. And it creates a situation where we're trying to hit something that, where there's basically not a lot of upside, and we're mostly talking about downside. And so if we are yellow or we are red, right, what are the questions that we get asked? When will it be done? Why won't it be done on time? What obstacles are we facing that will, you know, that are causing this delay? But, you know, that's not a bad question. And these aren't unreasonable questions, right? I understand. I probably ask these questions a million times in my career, right? I get it, right? But it doesn't exactly inspire. These aren't necessarily the best questions to answer to get us to better product outcomes, right? Because what happens is when we make it an inquisition and when people are afraid to tell the truth, we wind up with watermelon projects, right? And watermelon projects are ones that have green status on the outside, but are really in trouble. They're red on the inside, right? And so let's think about that, right? What are the kind of the lies that are going on here, right? We talked about the fact that we don't know the exact day that we'll complete a release or feature, right? At the beginning, we might have a wide range and then it kind of gets smaller, right? That cone of uncertainty, but we never talk about that. And then, you know, the only risk that we're talking about in these meetings is schedule and delivery risk. And those are real risks, right? And like, they're important, but like the thing that would be bothering me as a leader is I'm investing all this money. And even when we get really good at delivering stuff and knowing when we're going to deliver it, if people are using it only 20% of the time, right, and the other 80% of the time, we just wasted a lot of money. Like, shouldn't we be talking something about that as well? Like, and are we learning anything about that as we go along? You know, and, you know, people are not very honest in their assessments. And, you know, I think there are more important questions we should be talking about. And I just want to stop for a second and focus on this. And I put it in neon yellow, I guess, because I wanted people to pay attention to this. But so in this meeting, we're only focused on schedule and delivery risk, which we talk about isn't even the most important risk. But to make matters worse, we're not even getting good information on this risk, right? Because people are hiding it, right? And so it's a big, colossal waste of time, really. So, you know, like if we think about some of the things, some of the uncertainty that we're not talking about, you know, the things that are highlighted in blue are things we generally don't talk about. Are we still working on the most meaningful problem? You know, is, you know, are these features going to be useful? Things like that. And so we could ask different questions, like if we're leaders in these meetings. So what have we learned since the last meeting, right? Have we learned something new? Like if we had a bunch of uncertainty, a bunch of assumptions we're trying to, you know, trying to validate or invalidate, what have we learned, right? I think that's important. And based off of what we learned, what decisions have we made? Are we going to continue on this target? Are we going to pivot a little bit? We're going to do more of this, less of that? Or, you know, are we going to stop doing this because there's no way we're going to hit our target, right? And those are learning questions. Those aren't like inquisitions. Those aren't, you know, like, why aren't you hitting the schedule, right? Which make people feel bad. This is like, what have you learned and what decisions have you made? So it creates better conversations, more honest two-way conversations. And it's talking about the things that will actually get us to better business outcomes and better product outcomes. And again, like we talked about these opportunity solution trees, but what if we showed this at the meeting, right? And then we could talk about, you know what, we did these two experiments, or, you know, we were able to find out that this assumption we feel much more comfortable about. So we're going to move forward on that. And then we could use that in conjunction with, like one of the other roadmaps that we saw earlier, then like I think we're talking about the right decisions and the right uncertainty that's out there. This is just like a very tactical, like if you are working on a release and you have epics that you're working on, and this is a way that you can kind of help people understand kind of where we are on the journey, like whether you use story points, whether you use something else. It's like, all right, we've done about half of what we think, we've delivered half of, the things that we think are important to allow customers to select automobiles online or whatever, right? And here's the next part of that we're going to focus on. And if we've changed anything, let's call that out. Let's say, hey, we decided to cut this or do more of this or speed this up or put more resources on this, right? And it's not perfect. And like even the story points delivered puts a certainty there that's probably unwarranted, but it does show like, hey, are we nearing the end of what we think we need to do here, or do we still have a lot that we need to work on? And it kind of talks about, why we're choosing to focus on whatever we're focusing on next. So it's not a bad way to talk about the delivery side of things. And in general, like the planning is good. Like planning's good, but plans are often not good, the actual plans, but the process of planning is good. But if our plans assume that, we know exactly what we need to do and things aren't going to change, that doesn't fit real well into the world we live in. It doesn't fit well into product development. So ideally we'd revisit our plans, very often, right? And not hold on to the plans like this is like carved in stone tablets. Like this is how we shall, spend the next 6 months. And, I think we can do better than what we've been doing with our traditional planning. Right. And if you take a look at the whole planning spectrum, you can do really complex 5-year plans, or you could do, it's not really no planning, but it's ad hoc planning, right? Which is, okay, we woke up this morning, right? We are where we are. What do we want to do today, right? And just that level of planning. And you probably want to be somewhere in between those two extremes, but where you want to be like really depends on like, I mean, the way that you can vary your plan is how long do you, is your plan covering? How much time do you spend on the plan? If you spend 10 minutes every week on a plan, that's a lot different than spending 2 days every quarter working on it. How often do we revisit it? Right. And a lot of it depends on how much uncertainty there actually is. And we could debate about how much uncertainty there is in what we're doing in your particular organization, your particular environment. But I feel pretty comfortable saying that whatever the uncertainty level is, we're probably under recognizing it in the way that we do planning. Okay. And finally, we're like, so we've gone from the big roadmaps and then we kind of gone down to the release level. And now I'm going to go to the individual sprint planning level. And first, this is a little Gen AI interlude here where I asked ChatGPT to create a cartoon image of a sprint board for me. And the first one in the top left is what it came up with. And I said, okay, cool. But can you kind of redo the drawing, but only have 3 columns, right? And not repeat, to do and progress and done. I thought I was being pretty specific, but then I got the next one over to the right. And this is a little bit better. It's 4 instead of 6. And I tried again, and I got the one below that on the right. And then finally I got the one on the left, and then I just gave up because it's like, All right. We won't use sprint points here, but when we do sprint planning, right, we are pulling user stories onto sprint board, but first we're supposed to work, you know, product owner and the team to come up with sprint goal. And, you know, I'm kind of curious, like, I don't know how many people actually use sprint goals. They should, but then there's the, is your sprint goal to finish all the user stories you pull in? Right. Or is it something higher level? Like, we want to reduce the number of clicks that, that the customer, needs to do, you know, something like that. And which has primacy, like when we evaluate the success of the sprint, are we looking, did we hit the outcome of the sprint goal, or is it how many user stories did we get done? Right. And I used to be in the user story camp, but I've now come over to the sprint goal camp. And right. And so we're pulling stuff from the product backlog into the sprint board. And, you know, and there's a lot of good things about the sprint or the product backlog, right? It's very dynamic. We can reprioritize it all, and it's prioritized. We can take the top of it, right? Is the most important thing for us to work on, but it also has some shortcomings, mostly that it's linear. It only has one top, right? And so it's like, there's no alternate path through here. Yes, I can change stuff around, but, it's one dimensional, so to speak. And number two is, depending on how many things you have in your product backlog, or whether people view, oh, if you're putting something in the product backlog, it's commitment, sort of like that now, next, later. If you know, you keep putting stuff on product backlog and it keeps getting bigger and bigger, you're not being very transparent, because that stuff's not getting done ever, right? Like, we get to the end of the sprint, how do we know that we've been successful? What things are we measuring or looking at, right? How many people look at velocity? I mean, I think a lot of people have historically looked at velocity. If you're an individual team looking at your own velocity, maybe that's okay. But being faster doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that we produce something that was valuable. More recently, I've seen a lot of people go to say do ratio, which is like, okay, if you said you're going to do 5 user stories and you completed, you know, 4 of them successfully, like that's an 80% say do ratio. And certainly understand why you want to establish trust and predictability and things like that. But of course, if you insist on 100% ratio, then people aren't going to take chances, aren't going to stretch, and they're going to focus just on the user stories, not on the sprinkle. The release schedule, you know, sometimes all we care about is, does it move the release schedule, the date of the release, right? And again, understandable, but it's all about delivery. We should be looking at sprinkle achievement, but not if our sprinkle is sprint goal was to get all 5 of our user stories done, right? So we need to have good sprint goals in order for that to be effective. And then customer feedback, I'm kind of curious how many people actually have customers at their sprint reviews or otherwise providing feedback. Do they instrument their code that they're producing so they can see, like, whether customers are actually behaving, you know, with that feature the way that they thought they would? That's probably a really important measure as well. But what we met, whatever it is that we measure, right, we're sending a message to our team, and we're also telling them what we think is important. And so, quick question. So if your team, if you were a leader or in your organization, if a Scrum team uncovered something in their current sprint that because of that makes the solution that everybody was working on much less feasible, right? How would that, what would the reaction be at your organization? I mean, would it be positive? Go ahead, Greg, were you going to say something?
Were you asking me if it would be possible if they did that?
Well, what would be the reaction? I mean, what would leadership say about that?
They wouldn't be very happy.
Right. And understandably so, right? I mean, like, you know, but it might be different if it was the second sprint of a 10 sprint release, right? Versus it being 6 months down the road, right? Which meant that it, right?
Yes.
And the idea is that we want to encourage, we want to, like, if this is going to happen, we'd like to know about it earlier rather than later. And if people, you know, we want to celebrate killing bad ideas early, right? So understandably, it's not happy news, but it's much better than the alternative of continuing to work for six more months and then finding out that it's not going to get you your business objective, right?
Yeah, I would even add just reviewing with some stakeholders if it's close to what the original vision was in the beginning, too, before you get too far.
Right. And but I would say the stakeholders is fine, right? But customers too, right?
Oh yeah. If you can do it, I'd go right to the customer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or get a group, not a sounding board, a focus group. Focus group. Yes.
At least. Okay. So at the sprint level, basically the way that we act most of the time is saying that efficiency is more important than adaptation. Are we, you know, do we complete all the user stories? When we measure velocity, we're basically saying delivering more is better than delivering less, which seems intuitively obvious, except it's not true, right? Because first of all, we just said at the beginning of this that 80% of the features we develop aren't used. So it'd be better to get that average up higher than, you know, worrying about delivering more. But number two, there's a cost to delivering more, right? It's not just the cost of developing the feature originally, but you have to support that feature, you know, far out into the future. And it's, you know, I mean, I guess if nobody's using it, then that's not a problem. But usually what happens is you have like two or three customers who use it and depend on it. Nobody else does. And now you're stuck supporting that for a long, long time. And it's even worse than that, because the more stuff, more code you have in there and the more functionality you have in there, the more constraints there are when you're trying to develop new features, right? And so it slows down your velocity over time, even if you're doing refactoring. So there's a huge cost to delivering more, right? And when we're only batting 20%, that's a problem, right? And in a lot of places, like once we've decided we're going to go build this thing, people don't want to hear the bad news, right? But we should actually want them to bring up the bad news as early as possible and figure out ways to find stuff like that out early so that we don't waste lots of money on things that aren't going to get us to our business outcomes. And this is something that I pulled from Martin Dalmine's recent newsletter. And for those of you who don't know Martin, he's a very well-known coach. He tends to focus on the product side, but also on the Scrum side. And in this newsletter, there were a couple of things he said that really resonated with me. So he talks about our plans becoming an anchor that makes it challenging to respond to reality as it unfolds. Basically, he's saying our plans aren't very good, and the more time that we spend putting a plan together, the less likely we are willing to change that plan, right? And it's just, okay, well, we did all our analysis and we spent a lot of time doing this, so we're going to make this plan work no matter what, right? And that's not really, we work in an uncertain world and doing uncertain things, and we have to learn by doing and then adapt to that. So he talks about, you know, beginning with humble plans, right? And I always like to talk about humble recognition of what we don't know. And so I really like that, humble plans. And he wrote a whole book on sprinkles, which we'll talk about in a second. But, you know, like for him, it's not about planning less. It's about planning more when you know more, which means we need to plan more often. This is his book, right? Best book I read last year. highly recommend it. Whether you're a product person, whether you're a developer, Scrum team person, Scrum master, project manager, program manager, great way of looking at sprint goals and de-emphasizing this need to, get more user stories done. So I thought it was a very thoughtful and insightful book. But building on top of what he said, right? I mean, we know that the cheaper it is to do something, the more often you're likely to do it. That's just simple economics, right? And so what if we made planning easier? We did more lightweight planning that we could do more often and it was less time consuming. And just as a quick example, I'm dating myself, but back in the old days, if we were driving from Philly to Miami, right? We'd go to the AAA store or whatever, and they'd pull out all these maps and stitch them together and highlight the route and whatever. And it was a big pain. I don't even know if it cost money or not, other than the AAA membership, but like, it was a big hassle. You would only do that, like, if you were going someplace really lately, you had no idea, because the cost of navigation was really high, right? These days, right, we have the maps and the navigation in our phones, like for Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever you use. We use it on our normal trips that we take every day, because now we get updated traffic data and we can know, oh, wait, the highway's jammed, so you should go this way instead of that way, right? Because it doesn't cost us anything. It's really easy. So we're doing our planning, our navigation much more. And, you know, it's similar. That's what we should be doing with our planning, with our software development efforts. Just real quickly, here's another, Quentin Courtell has developed this fast, agile scaling technology. Not going to go into it into any detail, but basically it's a way of taking a bunch of agile teams, or excuse me, a bunch of people working on delivery of stuff and dynamically planning every couple of days, and they can reteam, they can dynamically reteam and things like that. There's definitely some pros and cons behind it, but I think it's an interesting concept of, right? And it's very much at the plan lightly, but very often. And, it's also depicted as a tree, right? And as they figure out new stuff that they need to do, they add it on as a tree. And really, you know, that leads to, right, we saw the opportunity solution trees, we saw these discovery trees, right? Is there something about a tree structure that might be better for us to use, given all the uncertainty and the different paths that we can take? So I'm going to leave that question with you. Basically, if you take any one of these things away after this talk, then I'll be happy that you got something out of it, right? There's a lot of uncertainty, right? Let's start to represent that in how we do things. That's probably the biggest thing. And trying to make space for learning and adaptation as part of how we do roadmaps, how we do release management and how we manage our sprints. So that's what I have. If you want to dig deeper into it or whatever, you can always use the QR codes or whatever. The top one's my LinkedIn. And the bottom one is my newsletter, if you're interested in that, on LinkedIn. I did a lot of talking. I don't know, were there any questions? Do people have questions now?
You can check, but I definitely like your newsletter. A lot of information in that one. Dave, do you have any questions? You're on.
No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. All right, then. I guess that's everyone. I don't see any comments in the social media world, but we'll see later on. And I guess that's it. Thanks, Gary, for sharing your information and your thoughts on that. I think that worked out pretty good. So, okay. Well, I want to wish you 5 years. Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Gary. And we'll have you come back another time and talk more stuff. And definitely look forward to, I know you're going to be doing the PO summit, right?
Right.
So we're going to hear your presentation on that. It's another opportunity. I think they're still free. You can sign up for free. Watch Gary live. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah. Yeah. So free will. You just have to watch it live. That's all.
You can't watch the recording. That's a trade-off. You want recording, pay for it. You want live, you get the free.
Right. And even the VIP ticket, I don't know the exact part, but I think it's like maybe $79 now that the early bird's over.
Yeah.
It's not horrible. And there's a lot of good people speaking there, like you.
Yeah.
Number one. And like I know Roman Pichler is speaking there, and Jason Little and a few other folks, Cliff Hazel. Like I know a bunch of people who are speaking there, and definitely is a bunch of great information. So,
and like you said, they're going to have different tracks. So probably paying for it's not a bad thing, because if they do the same tracks at the same time, you can go watch those.
Right. Definitely. I've, you know, the last few years, I've definitely paid the money to get the recordings. Definitely a good thing.
Well, I finally got a Rob Jackson on LinkedIn. Thought it was very informative. So I'm assuming he could hear us. Rob, you could hear us on the LinkedIn version, correct? And there's going to be a delay, and then he'll respond. All right. So good. He said it was very informative. I'm assuming everything was good on the other side of the world. And with that, I want to say goodbye to everyone, and thanks for coming out. And he says yes, the volume was good. Perfect. All right, thanks, Gary.
Cool. Yep, thanks, Greg. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Gary.